Welcome and good afternoon. I'm pleased to welcome you to this second installment of the Paul Olson Lecture Series here at the Center for Great Plains Studies. My name is Rick Edwards. I'm the director of the center here. I would like to mention that we have one more Olson lecture coming up this spring still. Ken Winkle will be talking about how the Civil War was fought in the Great Plains. Ken Winkle is a professor of history here at UNL, and around us, as you'll hear described in just a minute, are some Civil War artifacts that will give some dimension to Ken's talk. That is on April 15, which is the sesquicentennial of the death of Lincoln also. On May 14 and 15, the center will be hosting a symposium called Standing Bear on the Trail Ahead, jointly with the Nebraska Commission on Indian Affairs. It's going to be a big deal, and I invite all of you to come participate in the symposium. We will have activities on that Thursday and Friday. Thursday, we're going to have some movies over in Ross Theater that you're welcome to attend, no admission charge. The first one is The Cherokee Word for Water, which is a very interesting film. That evening, we will have a presentation by Sherman Alexie, whom some of you may know as an award-winning author and movie maker. Friday morning will be the Commission's traditional Standing Bear breakfast. It's been an annual breakfast. They're now going to a biennial schedule, but it will be on May 15 on Friday morning. And then more activities during the day, including a luncheon speech by Wilson Pipestem, who is the lawyer who negotiated the Osage Trust settlement, a $380 million settlement with the federal government based on malfeasance in the federal government's handling of the Indian trust funds for the Osage tribe. That we're going to have just a spectacular lineup of speakers during that time, and it will conclude Friday evening with a concert by Buffy St. Marie. And so I encourage all of you to participate. May 14 and 15. Let me ask our curator, Melinda Seaton, to tell us a little bit about the exhibit that we're seeing around us. Melinda?
Hello, welcome to the museum. So the exhibition that we're actually in right now was organized by the Nebraska State Historical Society. And it's a traveling exhibition, and we're actually the last stop on the exhibition and the only one west of the Hudson River. But it basically includes textiles, and the highlights are the quilts from the Civil War era, and of course other artifacts. This exhibition will be up through June 27th, so you have plenty of time to see it. As Rink mentioned, one of the Olson lectures will be connected to it. But if you're interested in getting kind of a more in-depth tour, every Wednesday morning at 10:30, we have docent-led tours that are pretty informal. That's a big part of it. So if you have a free morning on Wednesdays and you want to drop by the museum, that's a good thing to do. Downstairs, if you have time after the lecture, we have an exhibit of photographs of the crow from Montana from around the turn of the 20th century by a photographer named Fred E. Miller. And those photographs will only be up for until the end of March, and then we'll have a different exhibition that's up. So if you're interested in that, make sure to go down soon to see that. One other thing I want to remind you of is if you look at all of the little slips that are on your chairs, there's a card for you to sign up for. It's actually for a raffle to win a book, some postcard packs. So at the end of the lecture, we'll be picking those up. So make sure to fill those out if you want to get into the raffle. Thanks for coming to the museum, and we hope that you come back to see the exhibition.
Thanks, Melinda. Today's lecturer is Dr. Roberto Lenten, the founding executive director of the Robert B. Daugherty Water for Food Institute at the University of Nebraska. Dr. Lenton is a distinguished water resources and development specialist. He received his PhD from MIT, and he's worked with or at the UN, the Ford Foundation, and many other places, important places and important posts around the world in the field of water resources and water management. He was brought to UNL, to the University of Nebraska, in 2012, I believe, to really move the Water for Food Institute to the front rank, that study and advise on and improve the use of water around the world. And he has succeeded in that brilliantly. So the university has really been enriched by his leadership and his presence. I suppose I should note that Dr. Lenton has announced that he will be stepping down from that post sometime a year from now. I think the date is maybe a little uncertain still. But he certainly succeeded brilliantly in the job he was brought here to do. His talk today, which you can see the title of Storage Systems for Drought Management and Food and Water Security, really comes out of a comment he made at the drought symposium we had a year ago, in which he was on a panel and he commented that he thought one of the real issues in the time ahead was how to store water, food, energy, and so on. I thought that was really an interesting comment, and it sort of clicked with some things I knew, the little bit I knew about, for example, the great famine in Bengal in 1943 and the Biafran famine of the 1960s, where the problem was really not a lack of food in the world. It was instead a lack of food in the places where it was needed, and storage and transportation and so on. So I had been wanting to bring Dr. Lenton to the center for quite a while, and that was the spark that allowed me to say, why don't you come and talk about that interesting idea? And fortunately, he agreed. So I'm really pleased to present to you Dr. Roberto Lenton.
Well, thank you so much, Rick, for those introductory words. And I'm really happy that that, in a sense, offhand remark that I made at that symposium almost a year ago then provided the opportunity for this talk today, because it is an issue that I have felt to be important. And I really welcome the opportunity to dig a little bit deeper in preparation for today. So again, thanks for the opportunity. Thanks to everybody who has come this afternoon to share in these discussions. I should say right from the start that there are many people in this room that know much more about drought, much more about Nebraska, much more about the Great Plains than I do. So it's a bit humbling to be in this room. But I do hope that some of the ideas, at least, that emerge from experience in other parts of the world might be useful here. One of the things that I do see when I travel in different parts of the world is that there's a huge amount of interest in these issues of drought and how to cope with drought. Incidentally, a lot of the recognition of the expertise that exists here at UNL and particularly at the National Drought Mitigation Center, it certainly opens doors, that recognition of the expertise. But it has really been brought home to me so many times that people who care about issues of water and food security care absolutely centrally about drought, because if you don't deal with issues of drought, you don't really, you can't come to grips with issues of water and food security. So it's a very timely lecture from my point of view, a timely opportunity. And I should say it's even more timely because this week is leading up to World Water Day. World Water Day is March 22, that's on Sunday. There are a number of events throughout the week, throughout the world, our institute, but also throughout the world in commemoration of World Water Day, so that's something to keep in mind. I don't think it was, I certainly didn't realize that when we fixed on the date, but it's a nice, happy coincidence. So with those introductory words, let me start then to share some of these ideas with you. And let me start with, in a way, the beginnings for me, because one of the things that I have realized since coming here is that I've had the good fortune of living on three great plains around the world. And this is my third. The very first was where I was born and raised. I was born and raised in Buenos Aires in the middle of the Pampas. And the Pampas is the Quechua word, the indigenous group that was in that area, that means Great Plains. So Pampas, for those of you who have visited there, that's the name. And it covers a substantial part of Argentina in the middle part, but it also covers most of Uruguay and southern Brazil. And it's extremely flat, extremely productive agriculturally. It's the heartland of the agricultural areas of those three countries. And it's blessed with a very favorable climate. The Pampas, as you can see from the map on the right, is divided into, which is the area around Buenos Aires, where there's uniform rainfall. You don't need any irrigation. And then the dry Pampas, which are towards the west and the south, that's an area where you do need irrigation. But most of it is the humid Pampas, where the big challenge is how do you get rid of the water when it's too much, rather than how do you get the water to be able to grow your crops. So that was my initial exposure. I have to get used to this, not doing it too quickly. I was brought up not far from Buenos Aires. One would just drive through the countryside, and this is the kind of countryside that you would see, not too different from Nebraska. And so when I came here in 2012, this was sort of like coming home. It's flat, it's got lots of cattle, it's got lots of corn, it's got lots of soybean. It even has a Platte River, except that we call it the Plata. But everything else was very, very familiar to me. So I have to go this direction. So the second Great Plains that I lived in was the Indo-Gangetic Great Plains. That stretches from Pakistan in the west all the way through Bangladesh in the east. And it's essentially the plains of the two major river basins of the Ganges on the one hand in India, and Nepal and Bangladesh, but also the Indus in Pakistan, really highly intensive food producing area, lots and lots of very small farms, primarily wheat and rice in rotation in the eastern part, which is drier, so rice during the rainy season and wheat during the winter season. But as you go further to the east, it becomes more and more intensively a rice-producing area. It becomes more humid and more water-intensive. This, I should have mentioned in terms of size, the Pampas are about half the size of the Great Plains, the Indo-Gangetic Plain is slightly higher. It's a monsoonal climate, of course, rather than a temperate climate. Then, finally, coming to the Great Plains. So that was the new experience for me from 2012. It's been a really great experience to learn so much about this part of the world and getting to know some of the issues. And it was really in coming to the Great Plains that, and in a sense putting the experience in the Great Plains in the context of the other locations in which I'd lived, that these issues of coping with drought really came to the fore in my mind, because it really raised with me what is it that allows societies to cope with drought. And I'd been in places where where drought was coped with well and places where it was coped with less well. I remember in particular two really important droughts. One was in 1979 in India when the monsoon came late. My daughter Jessica was just about to be born. She was meant to be born when the monsoon was meant to be arrive. She arrived a month late and the monsoon arrived a month late. So I remember that very vividly. But it had a substantial impact in terms of agriculture and economic growth in that particular year. And then, of course, in 2012, here we saw this really the worst drought in the last 50 years. And what impressed me is, despite the fact that it was the worst drought in 50 years, that the agricultural production didn't suffer as much as one would have expected in a different kind of environment. So the question that I guess I have in my mind is, well, what is it? Why do advanced economies like the U.S. are relatively more successful in terms of coping with drought? Is it just more investments in infrastructure? Is it better governance of natural storage systems? Is it much better information, effective monitoring and preparation? Is it the use of drought-tolerant crops? Is it better farming practices? Is it crop insurance? And I think most of you are probably saying, well, yes, it's a bit of all of that. But I guess the question that I would have in my mind is, how can you start analyzing those different causes in a more systematic way with more of an analytical framework? So the question in my mind is, clearly in the different places in which I was referring to earlier, but if you look around the world, there's huge differences from one place to another in terms of various different characteristics. Very different in terms of natural endowments, in terms of how much rainfall we have, how much runoff, how much storage ability we have. There are differences in built infrastructure and how much has been built to cope with climate extremes. There's different levels of management capability, and there's different levels of availability and use of information. So it's trying to be able to get a better framework to understand the factors that allow societies to cope with drought is what been the question that I've had in my mind and what I'm hoping to be able to develop further in this talk. So let me go there. The purpose I've just laid out, but I'm essentially going to divide the talk into five different areas. One is I want to talk basically about storage systems and why storage systems are important. It might have been a bit obscure in the title. I'd like to talk a bit about thinking and rethinking storage, because there's a lot of rethinking that is going on and is important. I want to talk a little bit about a basic analytical framework of stocks and flows that that many of you have probably worked with in other fields, and then develop that a bit further in terms of water and food. I'm not going to talk too much about energy, but I'll come to that at the end. And then talk a little bit about indicators or the capacity to cope with drought. So I guess the starting point is that we really live in a world of both water abundance and water scarcity. It's simply a fact of life, and we all know this, is that the amount of water we have relative to our needs is very different in two points in space, and it's very different in two points in time. So here in Lincoln, we have gone through periods of drought, but we've also gone through periods of excess rainfall, sometimes within a short period of time, and that is true if you look at locations across the country or across the world. So that's variability, differences sharp contrast between abundance and scarcity is something simply that we have to deal with. Incidentally, that's the Platte River, and on the left, as most of you will have realized, taken, I think, in the middle of the drought of 2012. And on the right, it's the Mississippian flood, I think, in 2011. So what's the main way that we deal with spatial variability when we have abundance in one part of a region and we have scarcity in another, whether it's in a state or within a country? Or the basic means that we use to be able to overcome those differences is conveyance systems. It can be grids, it can also be trade. This is a picture of the California Aqueduct, and it's a very classic example of how you can simply build an aqueduct to convey water from an area where water is abundant to an area where water is scarce. And you have that in California, but you also have it in China. China is right now building a huge canal at cost of billions of dollars to take water from the Yangtze, which is relatively water abundant, to the Yellow River, which is running out of water availability. So that's one way of doing that. Certainly with grids, we use that in water, but we also use it in energy to be able to convey water or energy from one part to another. And one thing to keep in mind in all of this is that it's frequently less costly relatively to transport the things that are produced with water than water itself. And so it's relatively less costly to transport food, to transport energy, than it is to transport water. And that's why, let's see if I can get it right, that's why one of the concepts that water specialists use very often is the concept of virtual water, which is essentially the result of agricultural trade. So when you're exporting corn from the US to China, for example, you are in a way exporting water because the amount of water that is being used to produce the corn is essentially embedded in the corn when it is exported to another country. And this is a concept developed by Tony Allen from School of African Oriental Studies in London some years back, but this gives you a sense of what are the major flows of virtual water from one part to the other. Generally speaking, from areas where water and food are plentiful to areas where it is less abundant. I'll come back to the concept of virtual water again because it has lots of implications. So that's the principal mechanisms that we have available to deal with variability in space. It's conveyance systems, grids, trade are all ways in which we handle this variability in space. Now, if we're talking about temporal variability, when you have water in abundance at one point in time and we have scarcity at another point in time, then the mechanism that we have is we can't transport water in time from the future, from the past into the future. The only way we can do it is to store the water when water is abundant and then keep it so that we can use it when water is scarce. So it's the basic coping mechanism to address temporal variability is storage, and I use the word storage systems so that it encompasses a range of possibilities. None of this is great news, but I think it helps to structure it, to think about it in terms of how we have our responses. So essentially, storage enables us to capture the resource when it's plentiful and then use it when it is not. And we can apply it to water storage but we can also apply it to food storage if you view food storage as a way of storing virtual water. So that's a concept that I'll also come back to in a sense. So I had said earlier that one of the things that I wanted to talk about in my talk is rethinking storage, or just simply thinking about storage, because very often one doesn't centrally consider storage in these questions of temporal variability, but it's really important to do that in terms of a coping mechanism at its heart. So the interesting thing, and this I guess reflects a little bit back to what I was saying earlier, is that many of the studies, the calls that have been, or the analyses that have been going on about storage in relation to drought, have happened in the context of studies in countries that have in essentially the opposite situation that we have here, of very, very high climate variability and low levels of, in a sense, investment in coping structures. So much, much higher levels of vulnerability. And I'm talking about primarily about countries across Asia and sub-Saharan Africa, where you have exactly that, very high variability, monsoon climates, very low levels of investment in ways to cope with it, high vulnerability, exacerbated, of course, by concerns about climate change. So many of the studies that have come out have related to that. And by good fortune, they've come out of two institutes that I've been associated with in the past, so that I've been able to follow them quite closely. One is the International Water Management Institute, where I was for several years in the 80s and 90s, and then the Global Water Partnership that I was involved in earlier this, before coming here to Nebraska. And what these studies have been emphasizing is the need to look at storage in a holistic way, particularly looking at natural as well as built infrastructure. So the kind of storage facilities that nature gives us, as well as those that we build ourselves. They've been emphasizing the need to look at virtual mechanisms to store the benefits of water. So not only storing food as virtual storage, but also even weather and crop insurance schemes as financial storage mechanisms. So you can expand the concept of storage to include food storage, not only water storage, but food storage, but also financial storage, as it were, in these insurance schemes. And one of the very interesting diagrams that I've referred to quite often was produced by the International Water Management Institute, and it emphasizes that you can go from the physical to the non-physical systems of storage by looking at water storage that is both natural and built, but then food storage that is primarily physical, but then also going into what they call management strategies, which is already when you get into insurance schemes, and they also talk about water sharing agreements as a way of doing that. So it's an expansion of the concept of storage as a coping mechanism. So that little diagram has influenced my thinking quite a lot on these questions. What I thought I would also inject into all this is the concept of stocks and flows that hasn't really been explicit in what the Global Water Partnership and IMI have been doing, but it's a concept that is used so much in economics and in business and in finance, and it's interestingly it's not referred to very much in our area, whereas fundamentally it's a water concept, if you think about it. because most of the analogy derives from the bathtub analogy, where you have essentially the faucet putting water into the bathtub, and that's a flow. And then you have the water in the bathtub, which is the stock, and then you have the outflow through the drain. So you have inflow and outflow as being flows, and then you have what's in the bathtub as being the stock. And I'll give us some examples afterwards, but all of us in some way or another use that even in our personal lives to distinguish between what we consider to be stocks and what we consider to be flows. But just as an elementary concept, just to keep in mind, stocks are what you measure at a particular time. So at a particular time, you say the bathtub has got 50 gallons of water. But then the flow you measure with respect to a particular point in time. So you say, okay, the amount of water flowing into the bathtub is, say, 1 gallon every 10 seconds. And that gives you a flow unit into and out of the bathtub. But stocks have a hugely important role, have a hugely important characteristics in terms of coping with drought, because they essentially change the time flows, the time shape of the flows. They decouple the flows. They decouple the inflow from the outflow. They create delays. So it's the stock that allows you to cope with these ups and downs of inflow and outflow. So in economics, it's often viewed as the basic infrastructure for producing. I would add it's the basic infrastructure for coping with variability. So I think it's a useful thing to keep in mind when we're talking about storage as mechanisms for coping with drought. And the important point here is not that we have to focus on one or the other, but we really have to, when we're thinking about drought, we've got to keep in mind what are the basic stocks that we have, and we have to keep that stocks in mind in relation to variability, in relation to the stocks, to the flows. So my own view is it's that relationship between the stocks and the flows that is, in the end, the basic indicator of our capacity to cope with drought. It's the basic indicator of the of our vulnerability to drought. If we have significantly, relatively large stocks and flows that are small in relation to those stocks, we have a great capacity to be able to deal with the ups and downs. But if we have small amount of stocks and high demands in terms of outflow, we're going to be much more vulnerable if the inflow doesn't come. So the key thing in all of this in considering droughts is you've got to be able to think about both stocks and flows. So let me talk about water storage systems, try to go relatively quickly through this, but when we're talking about water itself, I'll come to the food part in a second. It is important to distinguish that in a place in any point in time, you have a variety of different forms of storage. Some of it is built, some of it is natural. In that diagram, also produced incidentally by the International Water Management Institute, those different forms of storage are emphasized there. Some of them are on the surface, some of them are subsurface. You have going from top to bottom, you have reservoirs, that's built storage. You have ponds and tanks. You have aquifers, natural storage. You have soil moisture that the farmers are able to tap into. And then you have natural wetlands, lakes, swamps, etc. So it's that combination of natural and built storage that we have at our disposal to deal with, to provide us with the water storage. And Obviously, one important factor here in Nebraska is groundwater. This diagram simply shows the extensive amount of active irrigation wells as an indicator of the resource that we had. But what I tried to do is try to come up with some very rough sort of back of the envelope kinds of figures to give you an order of magnitude. And what really jumps out there is the huge importance of the groundwater reserves that we have in this state. If you take the physical water storage, and most of it is Lake McConaughey, better said, and it's 2 million acre feet, and there's about 2.8 million acre feet of built storage in this state. Wetlands, lakes, and ponds, I had a colleague calculate those numbers. It's pretty small in comparison with the reservoirs. The only other significant source of water storage is soil moisture. It's hard to calculate that, but I think it's probably of the order of 2 million acre feet. And dwarfing everything else, there is the groundwater reserves, which is close to 2,000 million acre feet of water. So it's a huge amount. Just for comparison, very often when you think of what's a big dam, the Aswan Dam regulates all of the Nile floodwaters, and it's 107 million acre feet. So it's obviously, it's 50 times bigger than Lake McConaughey, but the groundwater in Nebraska is 19 times, so we have 19 Aswan dams here, and the state didn't pay at all for that. There was no financial cost, there were no environmental costs, there were no social costs in having the groundwater here in Nebraska. So it's a wonderful asset that should be recognized for what it is. And so when you have these numbers in this way, it sort of jumps out at you as to what this signifies. And one of the things that is really important when you have an asset as valuable as that is to be able to conserve it and to protect it and to make sure that it's with us forever. And from that point of view, the Nebraska Natural Resource Districts is hugely important. So even though Nebraska hasn't had to invest in an Aswan Dam, it has had to invest in the institutions that preserve this scarce resource, and that's the Natural Resource Districts that, in my view, are a remarkable institution in the state, and it attracts a lot of interest around the world. One of the things that the NRDs do is they track they essentially track the stocks and flows under their watch, as it were. And as you can see from this graph, which depicts in red the changes in the water level and in blue the rainfall, it's behaving more or less the way one would want to see an aquifer behave, which is when it rains plentifully, when there's abundant water, it's captured in the aquifer and the aquifer level goes up. And then when there's scarcity, then people tap into that aquifer and it goes down. But overall, it's staying at a more or less steady state. Now, there are pockets, as you all know, across the state where there hasn't been a steady state. There's been a decline. But overall, on average, this is the kind of figure that you see. This is from the South Platte NRD, incidentally. That's what you want to see happen. It's healthy to think about Nebraska's experience because much of the debate in the rest of the world has, in fact, centered around dams, around physical infrastructure. And that's really why this concept of not only thinking about storage, but the rethinking storage is important, because it's important to have a more nuanced discussion where you look at the different orders of magnitude, as I was showing earlier for Nebraska, and not only think of different forms of storage, physical and natural, but also think about different actors. If you talk about the built storage, you tend to think as the actors being the builders of storage, the big government agencies that build storage facilities, or the managing agencies. When you think about natural storage, the role of the farmers is hugely important, because in the end, it's farmers who are managing the aquifer, as it were. They're the ones who are responsible for tapping it, and they're also managing the soil moisture. So it brings in a multiplicity of actors, from the farmers to the NRDs, local managers, all the way up to the state, rather than having a much more, in a sense, top-down kind of approach. And what I try to emphasize always is that it's farmers and agencies at different levels, at different scales, that have a huge influence over water storage systems. So I still haven't got this right. One of the reasons I say that is that there has been quite a lot of discussion around the world that the reason why you have less, greater capacity to cope with drought in countries like Australia or in Canada or in the US is because you have more dams per capita. And this is the diagram that is often used. The World Bank, in fact, has been using this extensively to say, look, Australia and North America have 20 times the storage capacity of countries like Ethiopia or South Africa. And that may be true, but I think the if you come to a place like Nebraska and you see it's clearly not the physical built infrastructure that has made the difference. It's investment in the institutions that are managing the groundwater that has perhaps had the greatest influence. So this is the kind of it's shifting this kind of debate that I think is important. I was saying earlier that farmers and agencies can influence what nature has provided in terms of water storage systems. And farmers and agencies can, and when I use the word agencies, I mean from NRDs through state natural resource departments and beyond. But they can increase inflows, they can control the outflows, they can expand natural storage systems, they can improve governance. So all those are ways of influencing what nature has provided in the way of natural storage systems. And let me just give you a couple of examples. One is the artificial recharge, and it looks artificial, but there are lots of really creative examples of how you can, in fact, put more water into nature. This is from South Africa, that diagram, but I was reading recently, I think it's either San Francisco or Los Angeles has figured out ways, instead of having excess rainfall go out into the sea, essentially putting that into storage systems so that they can then infiltrate into the ground and not get lost and can be reused rather than be lost to the sea. So those are creative ways of expanding the amount of water that we have in storage. One of my favorites is the Ganges water machine. And this was an influential article that appeared in Science, I think it was in 1975, written by Roger Revelle, who was a professor at Harvard at that time, and one of his colleagues from India called Lakshmi Narayanan, I think it was. And essentially what they said is we need to have what they called the Ganges water machine, which was essentially exploiting the monsoonal climate that you have in the Ganges Basin, and where so much of the water comes during the monsoon season, and then you have a long extended dry season where water is extremely scarce. So essentially the article was saying, well, let's figure out a way that when the water comes gushing down the river in the monsoon season, let's capture that in the huge groundwater reserves there in the Indo-Gangetic Plain, and then figure out a way to make sure that that can be accessed during the dry season. And the interesting thing is that even though at that time it was all viewed as a pipe dream, many elements of that have in fact taken place, not necessarily in the grand scheme, but certainly the amount of tube well development that has happened since that time has vastly expanded the ability of farmers to tap into the groundwater during the dry season. So many elements of that haven't taken place. I've been gratified to see that, that there's been a new interest in this Ganges water machine. A book has just been published called Exactly That. There's been a bit of a sort of a greater interest in research and these kinds of creative approaches. Let me say just a few words about food storage systems, because that is a part of the sort of the expanded view of storage, and it is really useful to also put some numbers to the concept of food storage. And essentially, the idea of using food in storage as essentially a proxy for water storage came out of reports from FAO, where they made a calculation of how much water is in fact embedded in the stocks of grain worldwide, and they calculated that it essentially represents a virtual reservoir of 500 billion cubic meters, which I figure is something like 406,500 million acre feet. If you add the amount of water that is embedded in sugar, meat, and oil, and also in living cattle and sheep, you get an even greater number. And then they calculated what was that in relation to the built storage. And they came up with a figure that if you add everything in, it's about 77% of global built storage infrastructure, which is quite a remarkable number. I tried to look at that in the context of Nebraska and did some quick back of the envelope calculations in terms of corn stocks. If my math is correct, and it probably isn't, it ends up being about 15 million acre feet of water embedded in, if you take the capacity of corn stocks, both on farm as well as off farm, and about half of that amount for soybeans. So it's a significant amount if you compare it with the built water storage infrastructure, and it's a significant amount if you compare it with soil moisture. It's not very significant when you compare it with the huge groundwater reserves that we have in the state. So again, that the groundwater here just dwarfs everything else. But it is good to keep in mind that it is significant in comparison with the other forms of storage that we have. So something to keep in mind. Just as a very quick aside, not try to go back for the aside and just move forward, which is the very last part of what I wanted to say, which is the idea of being able to use this framework to get a more, a firmer grip on what I would call indicators of vulnerability, to be able to start pinpointing a little bit more about what is our capacity to deal with drought and the converse, which is what is our vulnerability to drought. So the question goes back to what I was saying at the beginning. Can we build indicators that allow us to figure out why it is that some societies are more resilient to drought than others? How can we figure out indicators that give us a sense of vulnerability or of our capacity to deal with droughts, and come up with a way of doing this that is globally applicable, so that we can have comparison between one part of the world and another, so that we could compare, to put two extremes, Burkina Faso and Nebraska, and try to start figuring out what you know, what enables or why is it that Burkina Faso has extreme vulnerability to drought. And the reason I say that is, if you get a country like Burkina Faso or Ethiopia, and you look at rainfall levels and you look at GDP, GDP more or less follows rainfall. So when you've got a drought, you go into a real economic turmoil, and when you have a good season, then the economy grows. So there's a huge correlation between the two. So the question is, can you come up with some indicators that are globally applicable? I guess the analogy that I would take in a stocks and flows framework is a personal accounting framework, which is that how much time could we exist if we had no income? And just to put some numbers, if we had $50,000 in savings, and our monthly expenses amounted to $5,000 a month. So we have a stock in the, our $50,000 in savings is our stock. Our $5,000 a month is what we spend. In a steady state situation, we're presumably making something of the order of $5,000 a month or more in order to be able to sustain that lifestyle. So how long could we exist if suddenly our income went to zero? Well, you get $50,000, you divide it by $5,000 a month, and you come up with 10 months. So the most basic indicator of our ability to be able to deal with drought in income is just the division between the two, the relationship between our savings and our expenditures. So the stocks and flow ratio is, at its most basic level, a way that allows us to talk about our capacity to cope with temporal variability, to cope with drought. So that's basically what we would have to do if we followed this framework. We'd have to have a calculation of what our stocks are, as along the lines I was saying earlier, what our total annual outflows are in terms of water use, and figure out a stocks flow ratio. We could do this for essentially for different parts of the world. So that is essentially the where I wanted to leave us. I am, I guess, two thoughts in mind there. I think there is some work that is important to do in terms of teasing these numbers out more, but essentially going from framing the issues as I did in my opening comments to going more into nuts and bolts and trying to put numbers more precisely into what I was doing earlier, and determining basic indicators with available data of hydrology, climate, and water use, and so on. And then testing hypotheses for the reasons for low vulnerability in advanced economies and therefore and high vulnerability in more low-income contexts. And the one last thing I wanted to say here is that I haven't really talked too much about energy, but because I wanted to keep it focused on these two main dimensions of water and food. But much of what I was saying earlier about food can also be applied in an energy context, because you just think of energy as the product of food, and you can think of systems of storage of energy and transport the same way that you can think of it for water. So a more complete analysis of what I have just talked about would in fact would address the food and water and energy combinations, the water-food energy nexus that is often referred to, and think about it in terms of stocks and flows as well. Well, that's where I wanted to leave you. And Rick, this is a bit of a long-winded response to your question originally, but I hope it's given some meat to what we had chatted about.
Thank you very much.